look back under the orange man's years, we're going to see a lot of bad things, and people are going to be very disappointed.
Brooklyn Council Member Jamani Williams.
One of the things that we're going to look back, and not the least of which, is what happened with the press under this time. Anytime you have fascism, anytime you have dictatorial leadership, the press is always attacked. And we've seen the press attacked over and over and over again. But we have to have places where the public can not only feel comfortable going, but feel that they have a part and a stake in the news that is put out. And there is none other bigger in New York City than WBAI.
Listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI. Become a member. Phone 516-620-3602 and make a pledge. Or go to your smartphone and enter 41444 and text WBAI.
Too public to fail! Too public to fail! Too public to fail! Let's keep up the fight. Thank you, everybody.
Greetings, it's DJ Hard-Hitting Harry. Tune in every late Tuesday, early Wednesday morning to Haitian All-Stars Radio, 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. for the best music featuring compa, zouk, afrobeats, and more Caribbean flavors right here on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Once again, Haitian All-Stars Radio, 1 a.m. to 3 a.m., right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
And I played that announcement, even though that show was on early this morning, to let you know that a repeat of a special production for this Labor Day weekend will be heard again, repeated on Thursday between 10 and midnight, of the Haitian All-Stars with Hard-Hitting Harry. So, there you go. Tune in tomorrow night at this time for a special musical chairs. And now we're going to hear Health Action. Unfortunately, there has been some difficulty on the production end, which means that we're going to present the program in two parts, starting with the theme and then a piece from Bob Lederer. And we hope and pray that within 20 minutes, the remainder of the program will arrive here at WBAI. That's where you're tuned, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org.
This is Bob Lederer. In this segment, I bring you an excerpt from an oral history interview I did recently with one of the world's foremost experts and advisors on integrative medicine for HIV and AIDS, as well as other diseases, including diabetes and cancer. Since the very earliest days of the AIDS epidemic, when she founded one of the first support groups for living with HIV, Lark Lands has been a generous and caring expert resource. Through those groups, she taught people how to support their bodies with good nutrition and an integrated approach to healing aimed at maintaining the immune system and overall body health. The goals were to give people a chance to survive until effective drugs became available and, just as important, to give hope. Many of those support group members are alive today, and years later, clinical trials confirmed the value of her approach. She was also the first to observe that nutrient deficiencies were common and contributing to the terrible symptoms like fatigue and diarrhea, neuropathy, and countless others, for all of which she found combined approaches that helped. Lark helped many thousands of people, both directly and through her lectures and writing, and that number more likely extends to millions worldwide. Many activists through the years let her know how much her work had helped, even in isolated villages in Africa and Asia. Many people attribute their survival, or a significant share of it, to Lark's expertise and guidance. And I have had Lark as a guest on this program several times, and she generously donated her e-books on nutritional approaches to cancer and diabetes to help WBAI raise funds. Sadly, Lark is now at age 66, struggling with stage 4 metastatic cancer that has spread to her lungs. It has no good treatment options. It came on rapidly and has worsened. She's now on oxygen full-time, unable to be off it for even a minute. Because she has many medical expenses not covered by Medicare, and because for years she generously donated her time and services, she has lived from hand to mouth for years. As a result, I and several other folks active in the AIDS movement have launched an online fundraising campaign to help Lark cover her medical expenses. More on that later. Now let's go to an excerpt from my oral history interview with Lark Glanz, recorded recently at her home in Georgetown, Colorado, while she was attached to an oxygen tank. This is Bob Lederer. I'm in Georgetown, Colorado, at the home of Lark Glanz. It's August 5th, 2017, and I'm really thrilled to be here along with John Riley, who arranged the engineering of this interview. And Lark, thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview, because you have an amazing life story that we really want to make sure a lot more people know all about. So why don't we start with just sort of the basic biographical things. Talk about the family you grew up in, where you grew up, and you know, where you went to school, and just sort of the beginnings.
Well, if I talk like where I grew up in Texas. and yes, that is how all my cousins still talk today. My parents were both teachers. My father was a college professor. My mother was a high school teacher. I mostly spent a lot of childhood time on my granddaddy's farm in East Texas, where he raised white-faced Herefords, and everybody else in the family raised cotton. And that was my childhood. And after going to school and moving around, I ended up in D.C., which is where I was when AIDS began.
Talk to us about when AIDS began, but actually, at that point, tell us what your educational background was and what you thought you would be doing with your life at that point. And that was, AIDS was identified publicly in 1981, so about how old were you then, and what were you doing in your life?
Well, I was 31 when they published the paper in MMWR identifying HIV. They didn't call it that then, but what they had identified turned out to be HIV disease. And I had actually done a lot of other things in my life, worked at a think tank as a scientist for quite a few years. And
what did you study or develop?
This was governmental work that you have to have major security clearances, and so I can't actually talk about it. Okay. But I was a scientist for one of the original 13 think tanks established by President Roosevelt. And I had just done a nutrition internship with a brilliant, brilliant clinician named Dr. Richard Power. I'd learned a great deal about looking at people and looking at their combinations of symptoms and ascertaining, you know, if anything they had going on might be related to some combination of nutrient deficiencies. He was the most brilliant person I ever knew at that, and I'd learned a lot from him. And in the early 80s, we had these people starting to come in, these young gay men who had combinations of symptoms. Some of them had already been diagnosed and some of them had not, but I started looking at them thinking, if you weren't telling me this was the result of this disease, I would look at this combo of symptoms you have, and I would think, wow, that's B12 deficiency, or wow, that's zinc and fatty acid need, or wow, you know, you need these six things because you're getting this neuropathy. And one of the people that came in was a nurse, and he had just been diagnosed. So he started talking to me about it because I kept saying, in response to him telling me, basically, he was a nurse working in one of the early practices where people were getting diagnosed. And he said, fundamentally, the doctors were saying, you're positive, you're dead, go make out your will. Now, I'm sure it was a more diplomatic conversation, but that was his version. And if nothing else, I just thought that was mean. I just thought, how can you say that to a person and take away all hope? And I started talking to him and his friend who worked for the State Department, who had also recently been diagnosed. And I said to them, you know, there's a gazillion support groups for death and dying. Everybody wants to follow the stages of grief and stages of acceptance that you're dying. And that's all any of the support groups were doing. There were none for living. And I said, I think we should start a support group for living with HIV. And we had some discussions about it, and we agreed it would be an educational support group. It wouldn't just be emotional support. So in one session, we would talk about good nutrition and how that might support the immune system. In another session, we would talk about these nutrient deficiencies that I'd been identifying, and we would start seeing if people responded to getting nutrient supplements. And in another session, you know, we would talk about absolutely anything that we thought would help. So we had people who were acupuncturists, or people that were chiropractors, or people who were herbalists. We had many people from different alternative and integrated approach to health fields come in and speak to people. And we made sure there was plenty of emotional support as well. And I made only one rule for the group, and that was that at the end of each group session, every person in the room had to hug every other person in the room. And I had many different people come up to me and tell me, after they were in their first group session, that was the first time anyone had touched them in X amount of time. Because back then, people don't remember this much now. Back then, people were scared to death of this disease, and literally people had been booted out from their homes. They'd been told to leave and not come back for Christmas. And it was one of the most horrifying aspects of the disease was people's fear about it. So that was the only rule for the group, and everybody ended up loving that the most. And as time went on, and more information came out about drug therapies and treatments for opportunistic infections, I just began incorporating that in what we taught, because we always wanted it to be a truly integrated approach. And an integrated approach, contrary to how some people picture this, has nothing to do with eliminating Western medicine. It is about integrating everything together. So you betcha, if there's an antibiotic that you can prophylax with to prevent PCP, which was a major killer back then, I'll absolutely do it. And so whatever was known, we incorporated. And John James became one of my best friends. Marty Delaney became one of my best friends. Everybody that had access to the latest and greatest information. And we constantly added that to what we taught people. And the rest of my career in AIDS kind of started by accident, because having been doing that for some period of time in the early 80s and learning, because, you know, there were like 20 or 30 people in each group. We were running up to three groups at once because nobody else was doing that, and people were desperate.
And were you doing this through a particular institution?
No, we just did it on my own with two other people, and unfortunately they both passed fairly soon. And so I was really just doing it on my own with kind of no support from anybody. And I did it for free. One of the tenets was we would never charge to be in a group. And I actually went to a conference, and I cannot remember the name of this conference, but it was the first big conference when people with HIV were invited. And lots of people with HIV, along with lots of physicians and researchers, showed up at this conference. And there was a session where this woman was talking about nutrition for HIV, and I thought, wow, great.
And she was a nutritionist.
Well, she was a dietitian, I believe. And she, I thought, you know, you always hope to learn something new that'll be helpful. So I went to that session, and most people were saying, well, we're having problems with this. What do you think about that? And she didn't have answers. And so very tentatively, at a certain point, about 30 minutes in, I started raising my hand like, well, we've actually found that with XYZ, this can help. And after about the fourth time I did that, to the speaker's enormous dismay and mine, the people in the room basically turned around and started listening to me. And I always felt sorry for her. It wasn't her fault. She just didn't know what we knew because we'd been putting it together in a different way. And several people came out to me afterwards and said, if you speak in our community, you know, if we put together an event, will you come speak in our community? And the very first one was P-Town, Provincetown, Massachusetts, which was AIDS Central back in the day. And I said, sure, you know, and that started me down the path of traveling to speak. And that ended up being 40 speeches a year in 40 different cities every year for about 20 years. And also that was unfortunately also unsupported. Sometimes PharmCos would be donating to the AIDS service organizations back then, and they would be able to pay me an honorarium. A lot of times they just paid my expenses. So I didn't make anything, and there's also expenses they didn't cover, like my cat sitter fee. So every time I gave a speech, I actually lost money. So it was a struggle. You know, I worked endlessly most of the time just for free because I felt like nobody else was doing what I did. I really, in some way, felt like I was in this position where I was putting out information that I didn't see anybody else doing. And I kept saying to myself, geez, Lark, you're in your 30s and eventually in your 40s, and you're not making any money and you're not putting together a retirement. And that's what people are doing at your age. And I just couldn't quit. I felt like that, you know, I would get another frantic phone call. The other thing I did when I was at home was answer phone calls all day long. And sometimes literally I would pick up the phone when I got up for the day, and I would trade off one phone call for the next and the next and the next until I went to bed. And people would say, oh, well, you need to take time off. Oh, you should take weekends off. And every time anyone ever said that to me, it made me think of a particular person who's, at this point, I had an encyclopedia about AIDS in my head because, you know, now I've been studying this nonstop, and every bit of treatment information I was adding to the repertoire. And I remember on a Saturday afternoon, it was late, I was so exhausted, and the phone rang and I just looked at it. But I thought, well, what if I don't answer it? What is the outcome if I don't answer it? And I couldn't know. So I answered it. And it was a woman calling from a hospital in Austin. And she said that her friend was in the hospital, that she had been told he was not expected to live out the weekend. And she gave me this description of symptoms. And by the combination of everything, I knew he had an OI, but he was actually dying from wasting. And I said to her, well, what you need to do is get very loud and very demanding. And I gave her a good friend of mine, Doug Wilmore, who was a surgeon at Harvard, had developed a glutamine protocol that could help restore intestinal absorption.
Just explain briefly what glutamine is.
Well, glutamine is an amino acid that can be in very short supply by the time someone is in wasting because it's stored in the muscles, and people had lost their lean body mass in wasting. It was a typical aspect of HIV-associated wasting. And Doug Wilmore, a surgeon at Harvard, had actually originally developed this protocol for preemies, and it got applied to HIV through his wife, Judy Shaver. And so I told her, look, here's Doug Wilmore's protocol from Harvard. You know, made sure they knew that. And here's what he needs for this, and here's what he needs for that. And I gave her a list of like 8 things. And I said, the problem is he needs them now, and it's Saturday. And you've told me, they said he might not survive till Monday. So the only thing I can tell you is to go be a raving bitch if you have to, and stand on the desk and scream at them Larry Kramer style if it's needed, you know, to get their attention. And she called me back a few months later, and she said she'd gone and done everything I said, and she'd gotten him those things, and that he was now perfectly well again and again practicing dentistry in Austin. Wow. And that was the call that always made me feel like, how do I quit doing this? And how do I not answer the phone 24/7, 7 days per week?
That's an amazing story. Well, I want to go back a bit to the precursors of your doing all this work. Obviously, you had to be pretty well educated in the sciences to become this kind of master researcher that you became. But also some of it, I know, a lot of it was self-taught. So can you talk about Well, it's actually two questions. One is how you got the kind of educational basis to become this world-renowned AIDS treatment expert, but also what started you on a path that became integrative healing?
Well, that's a very
uncommon path for anyone in the health profession to go. And I mean, it's more common today, but when you were entering in the early 80s, that was a very uncommon path.
Well, my answer is the same as most people's in my position, which is it was to save myself. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was a child. The expectation when I was a child was that I would not grow up to be an adult because I had a particularly brittle form, a lot of problems, etc. I overheard the physician telling my parents I probably wouldn't reach adulthood. I ignored that completely, and at the age of 22, I remember very definitively, I was just looking for some basic answers on a couple of things, and I picked up the first book I ever read on an integrated approach to health, which was Richard Passwater's Super Nutrition for Healthy Hearts, and it explained all about trans fats, which now we all know about, but this was in 1972, when no one was paying attention, and I expanded from that to the work of Jonathan Wright, and these are the people that I consider the pioneers in this field that I really learned from. I would honestly say that pretty much nothing I learned came from any time I was in an actual school because, A, they weren't teaching that then, you know, and, B, these people were so far ahead. They were the true pioneers. Russell Jaffe, Jonathan Wright, Richard Passwater, there's Alan Gaby, there's a long list of these people who were unbelievably ahead of everybody else. And they were all, in essence, agreeing with me, integrated approach means everything. No one's writing off Western medicine where Western medicine has a contribution. But like with HIV wasting, what I found was that you had this expert researching this one small thing. Then you had this other expert researching this other thing. And then you had this one over here researching a third thing. But nobody was putting it together. So I felt like what I often did that made the difference was I looked at everything and tried to integrate it. And say, well, if it's wasting, we need to address the anorexia because appetite loss is a terrible contributor to it. We certainly have to get rid of your nausea. We certainly have to get rid of your diarrhea. You're not going to restore lean body mass if you're sending it all down the toilet every day. You know, we certainly need to test your hormones and make sure your testosterone is right because we found out early on with Columbia research done by Judith Rapkin and her husband that people with HIV were living with low testosterone and that was contributing to wasting. So, you know, and later we've had things like human growth hormone, which really was a miracle for HIV-associated wasting when it first came out. But it always had to be everything. You had to give people the good nutrition, fix their hormones, make sure that they were not fat intolerant. Many people with HIV turned out to be fat intolerant, and people were trying to get them to gain weight by giving them these high-fat things, and that was causing horrible diarrhea. So you had to check for lactose intolerance. It was this whole comprehensive approach that you had to do. And I feel like on some level, just because I was trying to save myself initially, and I was reading 8 million different things and integrating it together, that kind of like taught me that. And it also taught me when I was working with individuals, what I learned very often you would see is that if you just let someone keep talking, they will tell you. They will tell you what's wrong. And physicians often didn't do that. Maybe it's because their HMO said they could only have 8 minutes. But whatever, they didn't let them keep talking. And I would let people keep talking for an hour, or in some cases, 2 hours or 3 hours. And the first thing they told me wasn't as meaningful. The second thing wasn't. But when they told me the fourth thing, a pattern would emerge. And you'd say, aha, okay, now this makes sense. And then you would know what they needed. And I think pattern recognition is huge in all diseases, but certainly in this one. So I started down the path to save myself, and I sort of learned an approach that could help to save people with HIV. And it's just learn it all, put it all together, and do it all. And I actually used to start my speeches by saying, I want you to know, I'm telling you that you need to do a lot of different things. And I want you to know that I'm not speaking off the top of my head about that. I actually do understand what it's like to live with a difficult disease because I've lived with one all my life. And I would give them a brief bit, and there were some funny moments associated with it, say, listen, I'm talking about you taking a bunch of pills and getting your hormones fixed and doing the right kind of lean bodybuilding exercise and plus taking your drugs on time and perfectly and without fail. And and that was post-96 when we finally had drugs. And I said, I know it's a lot. And here's what I do every day. I jab my finger with a sharp instrument 10 to 14 times a day to test my blood sugar. I take 3 to 6 injections per day to give myself insulin. I take way more supplements than you will probably ever take. You know, I go to the trouble to eat perfect nutrition all the time, even when I'm traveling, which, yes, can be difficult. I do the lean bodybuilding exercise that diabetics need because it raises insulin sensitivity. Trust me, I know how difficult living with the disease is. And in my case, you're living with terrible symptoms with HIV in some cases. I get up some days feeling poisoned by high blood sugar. It's not a symptom you can really describe to people if they're not diabetic. It feels like every cell in your body is poisoned and you can barely drag yourself to take your insulin, and then you have to sit and wait multiple hours for your blood sugar to normalize. Other days, I may wake up in the night with my blood sugar at 39, which is not a healthy blood sugar. You're not too far away from dying at that point, and it sets off a chain reaction, and your adrenal glands respond, and they fire off and cause jitteriness and freezing cold and a lot of other miserable symptoms. And then your blood sugar rebounds, because when it goes that low, it always rebounds, and then you have to deal with the high blood sugar. So I know what it's like to go through every day in that balancing act and always having to deal with one more thing. And I would never tell you it's easy. I'm just telling you, I think it's possible. And I felt like I didn't do that initially for the first couple of years I gave speeches. And then I did it kind of by accident sometime because somebody asked me a question. And from that point on, I realized that that seemed to be the point where people really started listening. Because it's like, ah, okay, all right. She's not just a physician telling this who's never experienced the disease. She actually knows what it's like to live with something difficult. And somehow that made people sit back and relax and listen better. Plus, I always tried to use a lot of humor in my speeches, and nobody thought it was particularly funny, AIDS, at that time. But believe me, there were plenty of funny things. And I always noticed if you get people laughing, they take a deep breath and sit back and relax, and then they listen to the rest of your talk.
And again, that was longtime integrative treatment expert and counselor Lark Lanz in an oral history interview she did recently with me. Last month, Sean Strube, the founder of PAWS, a national magazine for people living with HIV and AIDS, wrote in an email to Lark, quote, "Your kindness, patience, and hope were always infectious. No matter how dire the situation, no matter how few options seemed available, you always gave me and others hope and a science-based strategy that kept many people going when they might have otherwise given up," unquote. Again, Lark herself is now struggling with life-threatening metastatic cancer in her lungs. If you would like to donate at any level to the fundraising campaign for her medical expenses, please go to www.gofundme.com/helplarklands. That's LARKLANDS. Again, www.gofundme.com/helplarklands. Your thoughts, prayers, healing energy, or whatever you have to offer are most welcome. For Health Action, this is Paul Ringer.
Welcome to our Health Action Special. We'll be taking a look at the new documentary out called Now is the Time, which argues for a single-payer national health insurance program here in the United States. Takes a look at the policy aspects as well as the politics. Joining us are the two filmmakers, Lori Simons and Terry Sternberg, who made the film. Welcome to Health Action.
Thank you.
This film is actually a sequel to your first film, so let's sort of start with that. But even before we start with that, what was the impetus to make the first film? The first film was called The Healthcare Movie. What's its focus and what was the impetus? And then we can talk about your latest film.
Okay. Well, The Healthcare Movie was conceived back in 2009, and it was at a Thanksgiving dinner we were having with friends, and I had just finished a course in filmmaking. I'm a counselor by trade, but I really wanted to make films. And our friends, or somebody said, somebody, in 2009, by the way, that was when we were hearing all these things about the Affordable Care Act.
That's when the whole legislative fight was happening in Congress, right?
And I grew up in Canada, and had come to the United States in 1992 with Terry and our kids, and we started hearing people in 1992, when Hillary Clinton was trying to do something with health care, saying things about Canada that we didn't recognize. And we started thinking, wait a minute, that's not the country we just came from, is it? Like, really? Is it really like that there? And so it took us a while to realize that, that people in the U.S. really had an attitude about the healthcare system in Canada that wasn't our experience. And then fast forward 2009, I finished this course in filmmaking, and somebody said, you know, you guys, somebody ought to make a film about the healthcare system in Canada for the American audience so that they would know about it. And our friend said, well, why don't you guys make it?
There you go, see?
So we reluctantly set out. We traveled to four different provinces, and what we discovered in making that film was kind of surprising to us, actually. We discovered that the healthcare systems in Canada and the U.S. in the 1950s, when I was a little girl, were pretty much identical. And, the, you know, people would pay into a plan that was run by doctors, and they'd have doctor visits. They'd pay into a plan by hospitals, and they'd have hospital services. And, in fact, when I was a little girl, my parents lived back and forth between Canada and the U.S., and it was pretty much the same. And then things started to change. And in Canada, the film goes into what happened in Canada. There was a politician by the name of Tommy Douglas.
Yes, a very beloved politician.
Province of Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
And he was very determined that everyone should have health care. And so the film actually delves into what happened in Canada when, in the 1960s, about 1961, he managed to get public health care passed in the state of, in the province of Saskatchewan.
Right.
And after it was passed, they had to implement it, and it wasn't a pretty sight. There was a lot of things that happened that
there was
got
a
in the
major
way.
Doctor strike, right?
Major strike. So the film kind of goes into what happened in Canada. It wasn't a walk in the park for them to get the national health care, but once they got it, they they loved it. It spread across Canada quickly, and people in Canada really dearly love their health care system, and you wouldn't dare take it away from them.
So, in the broadest of strokes, how does the system work that's different from the U.S.?
Well, it's funded by progressive taxation, so people who make a lot of money
pay more
in taxes. It's not directly taxed. You don't get taxed for health care. You get taxed, period.
Right.
And out of the taxes, the government spends whatever's necessary to provide health care. Every single person who resides in Canada is covered for every medical expense, hospitalization, doctor's bills, surgeries, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
There's no questions asked except for how are you when you go into emergency.
There you go.
So in the meantime,
does it hurt, right?
Where does it hurt? Right? Yeah, not where's your card or
where's your wallet
or something. Well, you do have a card, but everybody gets the same card. That's why they call it, by the way, single payer.
Right. There's one source of payment. Right.
But meanwhile, we also found out that in the U.S., ever since way before even 1948, there was campaigns that were waged to dissuade the American public from wanting a national health care system, and that that there were people hired to create promotional campaigns that would dissuade people. And the term that they decided to coin was socialized medicine. Nobody wants that. And so that was in 1948,
right,
so come up to 2009,
yeah.
And we're still hearing people say, oh, we don't want socialized medicine, and I don't think they even really knew what it was. And besides, in Canada, they don't have socialized medicine. They have that in England. In Canada, they have socialized financing of health care, and the doctors are private and so on, but there's only one payer, and that's the government.
Right.
So that's why we made the first film, because we really wanted to correct misperceptions people had about Canada.
And just for the record, Ronald Reagan began his political career selling recordings of him bashing the idea of a national of socialized insurance medicine in the United States.
And he is featured in that film as well. The other thing that was very fortuitous was that the narrator of the healthcare movie is Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh.
and we were very fortunate to get him. And if
he's a descendant of Tommy Douglas, is that
well,
right?
If you watch the movie, you will find out what the connection is.
Yeah. Okay.
So
great.
Yeah.
All right. So on to the next movie. So you put this movie out to first movie out to sort of set the record straight about what is the Canadian system like. The second movie was well, Terry, let me turn to you.
Okay.
Sort of when was it made? What was the impetus for it? What was your goal in that in the new film?
Well, the new movie came out just last December,
and
was put together relatively quickly compared to the healthcare movie because we wanted to get it done before the election. We didn't know what was going to happen in the election, but single payer, we knew something big was going to go on with healthcare after the election, and so we put that one together relatively quickly. You know, having lived in the main reason that I wanted to make this movie was that, having lived in Canada and having already studied and done the healthcare movie, done a lot of research, it just seemed to me like such a no-brainer that single-payer healthcare, national healthcare, was so much less expensive. Everybody could be covered. And it just seemed like a real mystery to me why this was not done in the United States. And so the second movie was really geared toward for me personally to find out what was going on that there wasn't more of a discussion about single payer health care in the government and so forth. And we actually have a scene in the courtroom, not the courtroom, the hearings with Baucus that really explains
Senator Baucus,
about why that didn't happen, why that hasn't happened.
Right.
For me, that was a primary reason that we wanted to do that. And people still are using the exact same arguments, using almost the exact same phrases that we heard when we were making the healthcare movie. From 50, 60 years ago. It's almost word for word, talking about socialized medicine. And, of course, the big thing in Canada, ye heard two things. It's socialized medicine and you have to wait. You know, nobody wants to wait. So those are the two things. Once that's brought up in the conversation stops.
And, of course, we all know that we often have to wait quite a long period of time here in the United States to get any kind of a healthcare treatment, too. So it's ubiquitous. Let's put it that way. So let's talk a little bit about the film itself, Now Is the Time. Why did you choose that title?
Wow, that's a good question. That is the name of a song that we knew very well when we traveled with a musician by the name of Bob Wickline.
Okay.
And he had done a number of songs about healthcare, and one of them was called Now's the Time for We the People.
Okay.
And when we were thinking about...
It's featured in the film, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that particular song is the theme song for the film.
Okay.
And so when we were thinking about the film, and we were thinking about how the Affordable Care Act, you know, it had come on the scene, it was doing some regulation of the insurance companies, which was a good thing compared to before when, they had pre-existing conditions and all of that. But it still was putting the insurance companies in the middle of between us and our health care, which had never happened in Canada, by the way, with regards to doctor and medical care. And so we were thinking, and also Colorado was gearing up at that time for a referendum. They were going to do a vote.
That's right. And a statewide proposal.
To have a statewide single-payer system.
Right.
And so we really were hoping to get the movie done quickly so that they could use it to kind of educate some of the folks in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that did not come to pass because millions of dollars were poured in by the insurance companies to prevent people in Colorado from wanting the
There was a whole propaganda campaign that went on.
but we thought it was important for people to be educated.
So I guess the point of the film, before we get into the particulars that you cover, is that this is a film for people that really, well, actually both your films, are for people who kind of want to understand this issue better, and in a way that's, I quite frankly, watching it, didn't find all that quote-unquote policy wonky. It was very understandable. It featured people telling their own stories and experiences and so forth.
Of which we had many, mostly after we made the first movie.
Of our own personal story.
Well, yeah, so let's start out there, because the film starts, Lori, with your own experience of trying to get some health care that you needed.
Yeah, that was it was kind of mind-boggling. We had been living in Washington State, which is where my health insurance was, and our health insurance rates had gone up for there were three of us in our family that were covered up for $579 a month. In 2000, I think it was 10 or 11. And then
that was your premium?
Yeah, 13 months later, it skyrocketed up to like 920 and with more bigger deductibles and so on. And then Terry went on Medicare, and our youngest son aged out. He became 27.
Right.
So it was just me. and I, you know, and I was thinking, you know, I'm really healthy. I don't need all this. So I took on a high deductible plan, which, of course, was my first mistake. And then we went to Maine, and our, you know, well, you live in the United States. You're supposed to be able to move freely, right, and live in different states. Well, we were planning to go to Maine for 6 or 7 months on a film project, and then we were going to go back to Oregon to be with Terry's ailing mother. And but my insurance was in Washington. Well, being in Maine for 6 months didn't really lend itself to getting insured in Maine. I couldn't get insured in Oregon because we didn't live there yet. So I was relying on my Washington State insurance. And when I went to the dermatologist and found out I had melanoma. You know, the kind that you got to deal with right away, and it was right on my face. I tried to get my insurance company to...
There's a scene in the film that actually becomes kind of Kafkaian comical, where you're on the phone with the insurance company talking to somebody who's just answering the phone for you, and it...
yeah, it gets a laugh, usually.
That's just an example. We actually had others that we could have used as well. She had several calls with insurance companies.
Yeah, and then, Terry, you had an experience in the film that's documented where you're on a flight and have a medical emergency kind of come
I
up.
Actually fainted on a flight, and as a result of that, they landed the plane, and I was scurried off in a wheelchair, and they talked. When I got off the plane, there was like seven EMTs standing in front of me, and the first question they said was, "Do you want to go to the hospital?" So I turned to Lori and I said, "I don't know. Do I want to go to the hospital?" And she said, "I don't know. I'm not a doctor." So it was very, I mean, you almost have no choice. So, I mean, so I said, yeah, of course, I'll go to the emergency room. Right. And so I went to the emergency room, and literally none of that, it was a 10-minute ambulance ride. It cost $1,100. None of it was covered. None of the emergency was covered by the insurance because it was out of state. My insurance was back in Washington as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's sort of the way insurance has evolved in this country. Is now you're in a network, and if you're outside of the geographic area of that network, you're out of luck. So let's talk about the film then. So the first section kind of sets the table for the conversation and talks kind of about... what the current situation is. Yes, we have the Affordable Care Act now. Yes, things are better. More people have coverage, et cetera. However, it's far from a perfect system. What are sort of some of the main themes that are presented in that kind of first part of the film?
Well, I would say the idea that everybody having insurance is the be-all, end-all.
Right.
It's not, because people... having insurance is important, but people who have insurance are still not covered. The networks are narrow. They don't cover certain specialties. They have high deductibles. You know, like more than a third of the U.S. population still doesn't go for medical care because of the cost, because they can't afford the deductible or the copay, and so they go without getting the tests they need and so on. And so we establish essentially that while the Affordable Care Act helped by regulating some of the most heinous policies and practices of the insurance companies, it still put the insurance companies in between us, and the insurance companies were turning the screws tighter and making it more and more difficult for us to get our care.
Terry, maybe one of the key personalities featured in the film is a physician in Baltimore, Dr. Margaret Flowers.
Oh, yes.
How did you get connected with her, and She's featured throughout the film in various settings, well, including committing civil disobedience.
Right, right. She has had some history of that. We actually met her for the first time in Houston at a Healthcare Now conference, and so we knew of her and we knew of her activity and her actions. And you know, I've always been kind of envious in some ways. Maybe envious isn't the right word, but in awe of people that really walk their talk.
Right.
And so she was really somebody that had shown us that she did that. And so we had never really spent much time with her. And so going to Baltimore was a real opportunity for us to actually do that. And so we did.
And the film itself is structured somewhat of as a travelogue. You kind of go around the country and find people, and you start off in Detroit, which is coincidentally right across the river from Canada.
And I don't know if you caught the scene that we were standing there in Detroit looking at the Canada geese, looking at the Canada flag across the river.
Yeah.
And thinking about, you know, like, why doesn't the United States have a plan like they have in Canada? And we were in Detroit because Congressman John Conyers is there, and he's the one that introduced H.R. 676 to it's a bill in Congress for single payer. He introduced it in 2003, and he introduced it every Congress since. And he keeps introducing it over and over. And so we wanted to find out what he had to say.
Right.
Yeah, we gave him a copy of the first movie, and he said, "Oh, there's another one coming out now." And we said, "Yes."
Another place you feature in the film is Baltimore, where Dr. Flowers is based, but also you talk to people involved in a statewide campaign there, and in particular, a community organizer named Sergio.
Sergio. Sergio España he had an amazing campaign in Maryland that was very, very inspirational to healthcare activists all over the country. And he focused his campaign, or they focused their campaign, modeled after actually what had happened in Vermont, healthcare being a human right. And he was very instrumental in organizing chapters all over the state of Maryland and gathering a lot of people.
And he talks about that in the film.
And he talks about that in the film and what motivated him to do that.
And how that's all been going, right. And there is a big section in the film about Vermont in particular that focuses in on that and how they framed their campaign in Vermont, as you said, along a human rights sort of theme. Terry, do you want to comment on sort of what some of the main aspects of that section of the film are?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to remember.
You made it.
Yeah, we went to Vermont.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we have several scenes of them demonstrating, and right. We have several scenes of them Governor Shumlin actually was elected on the whole single payer platform,
right.
And then we go through that whole process of what happened there and right. Why suddenly at the last minute he decided they didn't have enough money to actually move forward with it. It was very, very important campaign, I think, because mm-hmm. Vermont, all the activists across the country were looking at Vermont as, is this going to work? Is this not going to work? And that last decision he made about not going forward, it wasn't clear. It wasn't clear, even after we talked to him, it wasn't clear to me why they did that. There'd been a major campaign across the state by the Vermont Workers Union to actually educate people, and yet
and they'd gotten an initial law passed, which sort of got the ball rolling, and then all of a sudden it kind of, when they got to the next stage where the next law was supposed to be passed to really enact it, that's kind of where the process broke down. And all my recollection is that although the governor claimed at the time that it was about the financing thing, that there were, as always with any of the stuff, there's a political aspect too.
Right, and people were afraid of the taxes, because in order to fund this kind of a healthcare program, the taxes would go up. And what the people didn't really know, and again, it's because of the PR campaigns that they hear about, they're mm-hmm. like, don't raise my taxes, but they don't realize that even though you pay higher taxes, you don't pay any premiums, you don't have any co-pays, mm-hmm. there's no deductibles, there's no co-insurance,
right.
you don't have to deal with any of the medical bills or issues, and it ends up actually saving people money in Vermont and in other places. So we demonstrate with some charts and graphs how that actually would have worked.
And Terry, maybe there is a big section of the film that talks about kind of all the aspects of how such a program would work, particularly the financing and so forth. And you go to Amherst, mm-hmm. Massachusetts, and you talk to an economist there. So.
Yeah, Gerald Friedman, who has done several studies across the country for different states, looking at the possibility of doing single payer in their state. And and basically all the studies come out, he says this in the movie, all the studies come out to about the same, that you save about 20% of spending just by going to single payer. And people hear that and they say, well, that can't be true, we're covering everybody, you know. But the fact is that is true. And the other thing that Lori mentioned this in Vermont about being afraid of the taxes, this is a very common, probably the most important argument that the opposition to single payer makes, is that it's going to, that the money is not certain, or that it's, you don't know where the financing is coming from. The same thing happened in Colorado, was that there was this huge campaign about how much it was going to cost, but they don't say anything in any of those campaigns about how much money is being saved. And it's always cost less. Every study that Friedman has done mm-hmm. shows that single payer always costs less.
Right, right. He did one for here in New York, because we have a piece of legislation here that has been passed through the Assembly for a few years running now, and his same study showed that. There's also an interesting aspect of the film where he has this relationship with a small business owner where he goes for coffee every morning, and he sits down and tries to explain to this guy how his business would benefit, and they have sort of this engaged conversation.
Yeah, that's a great scene. I like that. That was, and what this small businessman is trying to manage with his staff. He pays half of their health care, and the half that they pay is like almost a week's worth of their salary. You know, they have to work a week just to pay that, and that is high deductibles and has a narrow network. And, you know, he's pretty frustrated with trying to keep his employees healthy and wonders if there's maybe some other way it could be done.
So let's the final section of the film talks about sort of what's happening nationally. And again, you made this before last fall's election results were known, so the situation is a little different than I think many of us anticipated. But you feature Senator Sanders, who was running in the Democratic primary last year and made this one of his signature issues for that campaign. So.
Yeah.
Tell us about that section of the film.
Well, I actually was there in Washington Square in April when he gave this talk, and heard him say, now is the time for us to have Medicare for all, health care for everyone. And I thought, wow, I didn't know he knew the name of our film. So we have a little flash of him saying that. And it was just something that we resonated with, like mm-hmm. the concept of maybe now is the time. And even though we made the film and finished it before the election, before we knew what was happening with the election, and even before the election, there had already been 62 attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Even prior to that, which we knew about. And so this the attempt to repeal and replace made us think, you know, if people really understood how single payer could replace the Affordable Care Act in a good way, that's what we're hoping to educate people about.
Yeah, I just wanted to say one more thing about that last section, is that the real point of that is to really illustrate that the way we think this is going to happen, the single payer is actually going to happen, is that groups on all different kinds of, working on all different kinds of social issues are going to come together, realize that we're actually all working for the same thing, and that it's a kind of a movement of movement as movements, as
yes.
I heard it talked about, and that's actually happening since the election.
Right, yeah. So you put the film out a few months ago after the election. What's been the response? How's it?
Well, we had a five-week tour. We had a five-week tour in California because, you know, since the film came out, Colorado unfortunately failed to pass. But then California and New York were getting close, and so we did a five-week tour of California, and the film has been shown by advocates throughout the state of California. And we're just now getting started on our New York ventures to make it more available here.
And you're native New Yorkers from Staten Island, we should note.
we've been here 2 years.
So what was the? How are people using the film in terms of their organizing work?
They're showing it in all kinds of venues, libraries throughout. Some people take on showing it in every library in their state. They're showing it in community centers, in churches and synagogues and community centers and home screenings. There's some theaters that have picked it up. We even had our name on a marquee in
there you go.
San Rafael, California. So there's and so we're getting some theater exposure. We've been in, this film has been in the Real Works Film Festival in California and maybe in some others.
And what's been the audience reaction? I assume that probably some of the audience is people that are already sold on the idea, but there are probably other people who are there who this is the first time they're kind of getting some deep exposure to the topic.
Yeah, we'd like that to be the case more and more where, you know, we want to invite people. I think people on the edge, the people that are kind of wanting more information, this is a great movie for them to watch. And people watch it. We've been told several times that, you know, particular people show it to their neighbors or their relatives, and people change. Mm-hmm. They change their feeling about it. And that's what we want to have happen. So the advocates throughout the country are showing it. And to whoever comes, and so I think that's probably mostly people that are that know about single payer, but it's not just that. We've had several stories, like I said, about other people as well.
And I know you guys did a screening a couple of months ago on Staten Island to an audience, and that's known here in New York City as one of the more politically conservative parts of the city. What was the audience reaction there?
They were very favorable to it. They, in fact, out of that, we've been invited to Cape Cod to do a screening at a library up there. So, you know, even that's the sort of way that we distribute the film, is people come to see it, and then they take it on.
Yeah, and people running for office watch it. I think there was somebody at that screening that was running
for city council
or something.
Yeah.
Right.
So we've actually, you know, we've been pleased with the response that we get when people see it.
So we mentioned it very briefly, but there's one section in the film that's very compelling. It's a congressional Senate hearing that the Senate Finance Committee is holding in 2009.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a special edition. My name is Jim Freund, and this is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, a discussion and a story by Brian W. Aldiss, which I will read, and then after that, a rebroadcast of an interview from about 51 weeks ago with N.K. Jemisin. Stay tuned. Alrighty, so trying to do a few things at once here, playing with Facebook Live. At first, I had it in the Hour of the Wolf group on BAI. Let me move this microphone over for viewers as opposed to listeners. And this is the second time that I'm actually trying this out. And I'm using the front-facing camera. I'd probably be better off using the rear camera because it's got, A, much higher quality, and B, it, well, you see how if you're looking at Facebook, if you're going to the Jim Freund page or the video live, the live video page, section of Facebook, you'll see that the lettering behind me is backwards because I'm using the front as opposed to the rear of the camera. It's very strange. I'm not sure why it does that. I'll have to ask somebody who actually understands how that works. Let's see. Swipe left to see your viewers. Okay. I will do that. Now your other left, Jim. Or the other thing I can do is I can, with this computer here, I can go to my page. Yes, and I see it there, and I can see people there. And, okay, and now I can see people's comments. That's easier. Okay, very good. Thank you, thank you. And now there are at least a couple of people who are watching. My God, is that out of sync. So if the audio on this camera is any good, you can probably hear me there. If you're going to try to watch this while listening to the broadcast, pardon me. All right, say if you're listening to the broadcast, you'll have noticed I turned down my mic. Never mind, I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, look, we don't have that much time, even though we have a four-hour show. When I do the reading, I will turn this around, and you will see a much, much better feed at that time. Yes, I can do that. In fact, I can do that right now just to experiment by pressing this little button here. Come on. It's just I can't. Ah, yes. You see, that's what I'm looking at. Now let's get back to the other side. Well, there is about a 15-second lag between Facebook and WBAI. And for once, WBAI is ahead of Facebook. Well, what do you know? Okay, first promos. Next Wednesday, a week from tonight. In New York, it's technically Thursday, but next Wednesday night, September 6th, at 7 p.m. here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, we will have a thrill. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings is going to begin its 27th season, and we're going to have one reader from Brooklyn, traveling quite a distance in Brooklyn, and one coming in from Malaysia. Well, so like equal distance between the two of them. Randy Dawn is the one from Brooklyn. She is a Brooklyn-based author and journalist who published her collection of dark speculative fiction, Home for the Holidays, in 2014. And in 2009, she co-authored the Law and Order SVU Unofficial Companion, Durham. Her short fiction has appeared in publications including 3AM Magazine, Well Told Tales, and Eternity. Her story, The Visitors, was published in Fantasia Divinity Magazine this summer. She has stories appearing in two anthologies later this year, one of which features characters from her novel, Leave No Trace, which is currently represented by Bridget Smith at Dunham Literary. When not making stuff up, Randy publishes entertainment profiles, reviews, and think pieces in outlets including Variety, The LA Times, Today.com, and Emmy Magazine. She also blogs regularly at randydawn.com. That's RANDEEDAWN, randydawn.com. Now, our other guest next week is Cassandra Kaw, K-H-A-W. And I was not that familiar with her. Actually, I was, but I didn't recall her name offhand. And one second, I have to approve somebody to join the Hour of the Wolf group. There you are. Where was I? I just totally done myself in there. So I get an email from Cassandra Kaw saying Ellen Datlow sent me. Now, Ellen Datlow with Matt Kressel runs the Fantastic Fiction Reading Series. And they really book up in advance. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings that I do, we book up in advance, but there are gaps. And in fact, I double booked something in October and have nothing booked in November. And one can't switch to the other. It's complicated. At any rate, it turned out that, yes, I had an opening in September. And then I took a look at who Cassandra Kaw is. And first of all, she's in Clockwork Phoenix 5, which is a wonderful, wonderful anthology, which, my partner is in, and in fact got a, she, Barbara Krasnoff, got a Nebula nomination for Best Short Story for that. We did the launch April 5th. You can go to livestream.com and watch the actual thing. And then I took a look and sent an email to Cassandra and said, where else have you published? And she said, through this year, so far, she has sold, professionally sold, 21 stories. This year alone. Yikes. Today, I believe, by the way, in the U.S., and probably where she is in Malaysia, because I assume they're, I think they're about 12 hours ahead of us, it's her birthday. So happy birthday, Cassandra. And I've been reading some of her stuff. She's got stuff coming up in Lightspeed Magazine, for whom I do editing and host their podcast. Anyway, Cassandra Kaw, K-H-A-W again, writes horror, press releases, video games, articles about video games, and table RPGs. These are not necessarily unrelated items. Her work can be found in professional short story magazines such as Clark's World, Fireside Fiction, Uncanny, and Shimmer. Cassandra's first original novella, Hammers on Bone, came out in October 2016 from Tor.com. To her mild surprise, people seem to enjoy it. She occasionally spends time in a Muay... Oh, I don't know how to pronounce this. M-U-A-Y. I'll say Muay Thai gym, punching people and pads. For me, I'd probably be punching iPads. Her recent novel, The Food of the Gods, earned a rave review from the New York Times from N.K. Jemisin. Well, N.K. Jemisin, on September 3rd, is going to be on the New York Times bestseller list. No, she's not the one who was kicked off. Thank God for that. And Nora, of course, won the Hugo Award second year in a row for best novel. And she has sold her first, the first trilogy she had, the Inheritance trilogy with the Broken Earth and the rest, is going to be a TV series. So we're going to hear an interview done with Nora 51 weeks ago when the book that, in fact, just won the Hugo Award had come out. I was going to be interviewing her somewhere in the next, well, this past week or the next week, but I have not heard back because she is just super busy. So, with time to fill, I thought that we would play, rebroadcast an that interview from a year ago. And so we shall. I have an email here. Okay, two emails. One says, your audio on...